and welcome to Week in Review, your weekly roundup of news and analysis from OnFIF around the world. I'm Julie Levier-Vignoli. Today, we're talking about flattening the debt curve, a possible money supply boom in the US, and the IMF's epic virus battle. All that and more coming right up. And welcome to this edition of Week in Review. The pandemic has had tragic consequences and a devastating effect on the economy. As regular OnFIF contributor Herbert Ponish wrote, the only effective strategy against COVID-19 was containing the virus to flatten the curve. A similar strategy should apply to avoiding a full-on debt crisis. Herbert wrote, throughout this crisis, household, business, and government debt has risen. Households and businesses have delayed payments and taken on new debts to survive the economic shock, while governments have issued new debt and guarantees to support citizens and companies. Central banks have stabilized financial markets by pumping in unprecedented amounts of liquidity. Since the 2008 financial crisis, there has been record borrowing by all economic agents, amounting to 320% of GDP before the pandemic. The sums since the COVID outbreak have not been calculated, but debt levels will have increased. Solvency will have to be addressed sooner rather than later. Who will survive and what will assets be worth compared with the outstanding liabilities? Households will need to compare their remaining income with debt. Companies and retailers will need to guess future income, and governments will need to compare their reduced revenue with debt servicing needs. The worth of assets, such as hotels, planes, rental cars, or oil rigs, is unclear, as future demand is highly uncertain. What is certain is the level of debt and the contractual debt service. If the crisis is temporary, assets will be earning again before long. If it is protracted, balancing has to be done. There are two ways to do this, either orderly or disorderly. In both cases, one course of action tends to favor creditors and the other, debtors. An orderly solution would be through cooperative agreements between debtors and creditors. However, creditors, particularly powerful financial institutions and overstretched pension funds, will resist this. In addition, there are inadequate restructuring procedures for the non-financial sector. The prospect of a disorderly process would be debt deflation, in which deflation compounds the difficulties of debt servicing. Ironically, creditors would lose far more from such a process than from an upfront recognition of unserviceable debts. The only feasible way forward is containing the debt problem by negotiated debt restructuring. Households will have their mortgage loans deferred, and businesses will delay debt servicing, offering their assets, such as hotels or rental cars, as collateral. Governments can help by providing guarantees. Supervisory measures will have to be suspended to roll over the credit and debt service. Governments themselves will need to be reassessed. In a situation of across-the-board increase in indebtedness, it will be difficult to single out individual countries or groups of countries for downgrade. As more bonds are issued, prices will drop and yields will increase, a drain on future tax revenues. The market's confidence in a medium-term recovery will be key. Continued investment in financial markets will be one sign of confidence. As the debt mountain is flattened, the default casualties decrease. Elsewhere, OnFIF economist Chris Papadopoulos warned that the US is unprepared for a money supply boom, and different monetary theories in the US and UK could be to blame. Chris wrote, "Money crosses borders with ease. Theories about money have a harder time. US monetary economics focuses on the central bank balance sheet. Some theories link the balance sheet directly to nominal GDP and inflation. Others connected to broad money via the money multiplier. In the UK, monetary theories developed differently. The focus of British monetary economics is not the central bank balance sheet, but the balance sheet of the entire banking system. This approach starts with the observation that money is mostly bank deposits, a liability of the banking system. As an item on the banking system's balance sheet, it can be impacted by changes in any other element on the balance sheet, the so-called balance sheet counterparts. The main counterpart is lending to the private sector, but another important one is government bond holdings, which means money growth can be spurred by fiscal as well as monetary policy. This happened in the US toward the end of last year, when Donald Trump's budget deficits led to more bond purchases by banks, causing the money supply to accelerate. During the heyday of monetarism in the 1970s and 80s, when money supply targeting was tried in various forms, the UK relied on the counterparts approach rather than Friedman's multiplier. His main contribution to British economics was not monetary. It was the vertical Phillips curve, the idea that there was no long-run trade-off between unemployment and inflation. The difference in theoretical approaches across the Atlantic may owe to the differing development of banking systems. UK banks had achieved huge economies in reserves by the early 20th century because of a high degree of market consolidation and intermediaries called discount houses. This meant the level of bank reserves was rarely a constraint on British banking activities. The US banking system remained highly fragmented in comparison. Due to changes in the financial system, definitions of money require updating every one or two decades. Current US data is therefore imprecise. Analyzing the counterparts is also problematic. Comprehensive balance sheet data is collected from US commercial banks, but less so from the money funds that create money. High money growth is likely to persist. Fiscal, monetary, and prudential policies have shifted to a pro-employment stance and away from an anti-inflation, anti-deficit one. Second, policymakers prefer to look at the labour market rather than monetary aggregates, with the two currently giving opposing signals. Monetary aggregates fell out of fashion during the 1990s due to a loss of usefulness and perhaps associations with the free market politics of monetarism. But they have proved a reliable indicator of demand and inflation over the 2010s, more so than the labour market. If this continues, the US will find itself with high inflation, but with neither the theory nor the data to manage it. Our US chairman, Mark Sobol, also had words of warning, this time regarding the IMF. Mark wrote, "Emerging markets and developing countries face dire economic circumstances because of the COVID-19 crisis. Eyes turn to the International Monetary Fund, the world's first responder, but the pandemic raises fundamental challenges for the IMF. The fund is the world's premier balance of payments lender and macroeconomic institution. But it cannot lend freely, its resources are limited. Further, its operations intersect with those of other international financial institutions, official lenders, and the private sector. Governments often don't implement needed reforms. A wave of debt restructurings could be imminent. The fund's case-by-case approach to debt relief is not well-placed to handle a wave. Tackling this conundrum must be a priority. The fund should think creatively about supporting debt restructuring. A few ideas so far range from IMF sweeteners for debt operations or national laws based on the United Nations Charter shielding assets from creditors, as was done for Iraq in 2003. Finally, there are legitimate questions about IMF resource adequacy given the enormity of the virus. One debate is about a special drawing right allocation, perhaps under $650 billion, so as not to require US congressional approval. Whether for or against, there is recognition an allocation would only provide modest support to emerging markets in easing budget constraints. With a proposed new allocation not making headway, some analysts are adopting a welcome focus on redistributing existing SDRs, mostly sitting on advanced economy or strong emerging market balance sheets. Implementation may prove challenging given national laws and enhanced credit risks. Surprisingly, member countries have only made extremely limited use of their SDRs so far this year, around $3 billion net. Another is whether a quota increase is needed. That would strengthen resources, improve their composition between quotas, emergency and bilateral resources, and allow needed adjustment of select voting shares. The IMF still has $220 billion in loanable quota resources and more than $500 billion in emergency or bilateral resources. But financing needs will rise with time. Quota negotiations are arduous and should be launched sooner rather than later. The impact of the virus on the IMF has already begun. It will play out over years, requiring difficult judgments, balanced against a restrained budgetary envelope and other actors. It will be an epic challenge. Also on the website, we published an interview by my colleague Bhavin Patel, head of FinTech Research, who spoke to Saray Chia, Director General of the National Bank of Cambodia, about the country's soon-to-launch mobile payments platform, Bakong. Next week, on Monday the 29th of June, William Dudley, former president and chief executive officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, joins Mark Sobel for a conversation about the US economy. And we have two meetings on Tuesday, the 30th of June. First, Carl Tannenbaum, chief economist at Northern Trust, discusses the impact of the pandemic, looking at the state of recovery and policy measures taken by different countries to tackle post-pandemic challenges. And second, Thomas Weiser, chair of the European Commission's High-Level Forum on the Capital Markets Union, outlines the forum's recommendations and why a CMU is a priority now more than ever. And that is all for this edition of Week in Review. To read more about everything we've discussed, visit umfif.org or scroll down to the notes underneath this podcast, where you will find links to everything mentioned today. To stay up to date with UMFIF news, analysis, and forthcoming meetings, sign up at umfif.org/subscribe. I'm Julie Levia-Vignoli. Thank you for listening.